Phoenix Cinema Podcast presents a special film club episode, the film Never Say Never Again. Hello and welcome all to a special episode of Phoenix Cinema Podcast, and we're doing something a little different today. Today, we invite you into our film club to discuss movie number 207. And that movie is the 1983 semi-unofficial Bond movie, Never Say Never Again. We have been slowly, Ralph shaking his head at me, we've been slowly making our way through the Bond franchise, watching every Bond film since Dr. No, but not all at once. Because if there's one thing you need in between every Bond double feature, that is a break. It's taken us 3 years to get to this point, and I couldn't think of anybody better to discuss this movie with than my co-host and fellow film geek, Luke Parker. What's up, Luke?
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be back. Looking forward to discussing this one.
As am I. Great to have you back. And our fellow film club member, Hannah Tavares, is with us today. How you doing, Hannah?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining. Thank you for watching the movie. And rounding us off is our previous guest on the podcast and someone we had an absolute delight speaking to recently. Longtime podcaster and producer of the Getting Lost documentary film, Ralph D. Oppel. Welcome back, Ralph.
Thanks for having me. Seriously, it's completely unofficial, not semi-unofficial James Bond movie.
Right.
All right, I had to get that out.
Yeah. Did I get your surname right this time, by the way?
Yeah, it's closer.
Sick. Been working on it. So before we dig into this film specifically, let's briefly go around and discuss our individual thoughts, feelings, and concerns regarding the Bond franchise. Highs, lows, did you grow up with them? Ralph, we actually got a few of your thoughts recently on a separate episode, but right. Let's start with you because you're a big fan, right?
Yeah, I'm a massive fan. It's kind of a weird story for me. The first Bond movie I ever saw was The Living Daylights, which is like my number three favorite Bond movie. I think it's really good, especially after falling, coming after like A View to Kill, but that doesn't matter. So that's the first one I saw back in like probably like 89. I want to say I was on a family road trip and it was on cable and I watched it then. And it was awesome and I enjoyed it. And then I didn't really think about Bond at all until, well, either to Eon Productions because like, 6 years after they did, License to Kill, they did Goldeneye. Pierce Brosnan was coming back and they had done Eon had done like these re-release VHS tapes. And I had by that point decided to watch them all. And I've been a fan since like probably like 94, 93, 94. Mm-hmm. Something like that.
Yeah. So was Goldeneye your first cinema Bond experience?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Cause that's the difference of me being like License to Kill came out when I was like 13 and then Goldeneye mm-hmm. came out when I was like 17 or something or 18. So it was like that 6 year gap was like so huge.
Yeah.
In Bond, as far as all of Bond goes. But now that's like par for the course. It seems like they're just, taking their sweet time with these. So yeah, Goldeneye was the first one I saw in cinemas. I thought it was all right.
Just all right.
But it's, yeah, I mean, I was excited to like be sitting in the theater, and it's one of those franchises where I would go first thing in the morning. The Friday it would come out, I'd go to the first showing. This is before like midnight screenings, and I still don't like midnight screenings. Now they'll do like a 7 p.m. screening on a Thursday, so I've been doing that. But essentially, as soon as I could watch it, where I can be like refreshed with breakfast and like go into it, that's what I do. Yeah,
nice. Luke, what about you? I mean, you grew up with these, right?
Well, yeah, kind of. So I think I'm a bit younger than you guys, so I very much grew up in like in like the Daniel Craig era. And I absolutely love Craig's films. I'm in love with them. In fact, Casino Royale for me is one of my, it's in my top five films of all time. I don't just think it's the best James Bond film.
Wow.
I think Casino Royale is one of the best action films ever made, full stop.
Oh my God, you've never told me that. Really?
I must have done. I must have done.
I know you liked it, but wow. Yeah, okay, cool.
Yeah, absolutely love it. And a few years ago, I got to see Casino Royale live in concert at the Royal Albert Hall, and that was like one of the best live experiences I've ever had. It was really, really great.
Awesome.
In terms of the older Bonds, I thought I was much more clued up on them than I actually was. And this is what I've like learned as we've been going through it in the film club. Because I caught a lot of them on TV growing up. They'd usually be on like a Sunday afternoon on... We have this channel in the UK called ITV4, I think, or ITV3. Mm-hmm. And they just play like these old dad movies.
Yeah, it was a staple, the Bond films on UK television. Yeah.
Yeah. So I definitely saw a lot of these old Bonds. A lot of the time just in like snippets as well. Maybe I didn't watch the film all the way through. Because I've noticed going back through the films now that there's like a lot of different scenes, like iconic scenes that I remember really vividly. But
yeah.
I think I haven't seen the entire film all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think I do really like Sean Connery. He's like, in my opinion, he's the best Bond after Daniel Craig. But I think it's been interesting because I've basically realized I've had a lot more blind spots in this series than I thought I did initially anyway.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, interesting. All right. I mean, and the thing is that you go through all of them, so many of them meld together. I mean, he's in a car that drives into an ocean, it swims to the bottom. How many movies does that happen in? You know?
Yeah.
I can't differentiate.
Even just like trying to compare this one to Thunderball, because obviously it's like basically, you know, it's Thunderball 2.0, but
mm-hmm.
it was hard trying to remember what Thunderball was like because it's kind of just merged in with every film around it.
Yeah. right. Yeah. Hannah, what about you? Did you have any experience with the Bond movies growing up?
So for me, not growing up, I come from a household where our father figure really liked cowboy movies. So we were sort of a cowboy Western household to a degree.
Mm-hmm.
I think the kids, we kind of always went off to the library and borrowed whatever VHS tapes we wanted. So if I ingested any of that, it's definitely out of my mind now. But my experience with Bond has really primarily been only Daniel Craig's. And I think the earliest Bond memory I have is reading in one of those, I don't know what you call them in the UK, but the trashy mags in the grocery stores with the snapshots of Daniel Craig coming out of the water from one of those shots. And I know some of the behind the scenes, there was like a dune there or something. So he got out of the water a lot faster, whatever it is. So it's just visuals. And then more recently during my hiatus from film club, in COVID era, or like a year in, I was with some friends up in Maine and we were locked in during a stormy night playing Codenames. It's like a spy board game. And we decided for the duration of the night, we would only play all of the Bond themes. And that kind of got me more intrigued to get into the history of it, especially seeing that you guys were picking it up and going through the oeuvre. But yeah, very, very minimal exposure to it. But when I finally got around to catching Daniel Craig's films, it was Mads Mikkelsen that drew me in for Casino Royale. Quite limited, but I had a blast watching this. Never say never
first
again.
Time.
But also, I'm quite shocked. So, like, Ralph, he kicked it off, or like, correct to Chris, that like it is not an official Bond, and I did not know that. Like maybe a couple minutes before the call, I took a look and I'm like, what do they mean? Not official. So I'm excited to hear what y'all have to say.
I grew up with these. I watched these since I was a kid. Couldn't escape them, to be honest. And I remember the very specific memories. So my mum is a housekeeper, has been all my life. And I remember the time she used to let me not go to school and just go to work with her. And there was this one house she used to clean, and they had all the VHS tapes of Bond. And in a way where these are VHS, but you know, when you line them up together, the spines spell out 007, you know, taking up like an entire wall length of a living room. And yeah, I remember just watching all of these videos one by one by one. And I knew I guess I didn't know I wanted to be an actor then, but it was, the signs were there because I would play Bond in the living room. So mum's off, you know, cleaning whatever room, and I am Sean Connery, I'm Roger Moore, and what have you. And it was great, you know, and I didn't really have at that point, I wasn't able to form a real critical opinion or understanding of what the films were giving. They were just fun, you know, and any of the difficulties inherent in Bond, the sexism, the way women are treated, all of that stuff wasn't, it was just going right over my head. Now it's very apparent, you know, but yeah, they were just super, super fun films to me. So very familiar with the majority of them, including this one. I remember I bought the VHS of this one. Well, I didn't. I asked my mom to buy me it. But yeah, it was great fun when I was a kid. Didn't remember it at all until this recent rewatch. It's so funny as well that you say Mads Mikkelsen was the draw for Casino Royale, because I remember I love Mads Mikkelsen. I didn't know what he was saying. I didn't have a clue what he was saying. The accent was so thick. I guess that's just me.
I don't remember, to be honest.
Okay. Yeah. Well, then I guess, yeah, let's just dive into this movie, because yes, it is a remake of Thunderball, a movie that Sean Connery was already in, had already starred in. And it was down to the rights of the producer, and he had sued Ian Fleming or...
Yeah, this was at the heart of like a copyright shitstorm, really.
Massive shitstorm, yeah. Which even involves... What were you saying?
I was going to say, do you have the info? Do you have the info on it?
Not really. Not like in front of me. I'm kind of just going off. Do you?
Yeah, it's all in my head.
I please. Know all this stuff. Please enlighten us, please.
So essentially what happened was that there was this guy, Kevin McClory, who is a producer and was going to make a movie with Ian Fleming, a Bond movie. And it was essentially Thunderball. And so Thunderball was going to be this movie. Then Eon comes in and starts producing the James Bond movies, and that movie kind of gets shelved. And so what Ian Fleming does is he goes and writes the book Thunderball, which included material that Kevin McClory and him were putting in the screenplay. And so Kevin McClory's like, hold the phone.
Ooh.
Like Spectre and Blofeld, like Largo and Domino. And like, these are like stuff that I created with Ian Fleming, and now Eon wants to do this.
But he doesn't credit him at all in the book, does he?
I don't believe so.
Ooh, ouch.
And Kevin McClory's mad. So what happens is the producers, Eon, wants to make Thunderball. They like the book. The book is great, whatever. And there's this problem, this Kevin McClory guy. So what they do is basically throw him a bone and say, you know, we'll bring you on as a producer for Thunderball. So he gets credited in Thunderball as a producer, but you can't touch any of this stuff for, I think it's like 10 years or something.
Ooh, wow.
So like all of this fighting goes on. And then finally in 1983, he's able to produce his own James Bond movie, which is this. And because Sean Connery had a falling out with Eon, he did not care for Albert Broccoli at all.
He's like,
I'll go do that movie for you. I'll come out and I'll be James Bond and come and do this guy's movie because he's going to pay me. So what's crazy is this whole Kevin McClory thing is a giant mess up until Quantum of Solace, where they finally settle something out of court with Kevin McClory, and they're able to get the rights back to Blofeld, Spectre, and a lot of that stuff.
Oh, right.
So that's why Blofeld, at the height of their bickering, probably noticed that Blofeld disappeared after Diamonds Are Forever. There is a scene at the beginning, the pre-credit sequence for Eyes Only, where there is
crazy.
A man who is bald with a cat in a wheelchair.
Right.
And
there's balloons. And
so there's a line in For Your Eyes Only where the bald man says, "I'll give you," he's pleading to James Bond, and he says, "I'll give you anything you want. I'll give you a delicatessen in stainless steel."
Yeah.
Which that makes no sense.
Right.
Unless you are like Albert Broccoli and understand how mobsters work, and that's like some famous like mobster like threat or saying, and they were treating Blofeld in that as Kevin McClory. So that line, "I'll give you a delicatessen in stainless steel," is like a dig at Kevin McClory acting like a mob boss. So that was like it. Like, there's been no Blofeld at all. So when they announced Spectre was coming out, it was like, oh, they got the rights. It's happening. They're able to do Blofeld again. So it's Kevin McClory, this movie has to be a remake of Thunderball. Kevin McClory can't tell any other stories. He can make a Thunderball movie every year, the same movie remake, and use those characters. So that's the whole deal with this movie, is like they were fighting, and this is a movie out of spite for both him and Sean Connery.
That is insane. That's crazy.
Because this movie misses so much of like the classic Bond elements. You know, it hasn't got Bond shooting down the barrel. It hasn't got that iconic. So yeah.
And it makes so much sense because, what was the movie? For Your Eyes Only, that opening sequence? Yeah. It's nuts. I mean, they position Blofeld as being the big boss, the villain of, you know, the leader of Spectre this entire, and they dispose of him in a way that's just like, you know, fuck you. And that, you know,
it's like the first 8 minutes or something.
Yes. Yes, and he just drops him down like this chute, down like this
down
tunnel,
a chimney, yeah.
Down a chimney, yeah. It's, very, very strange, but that makes a lot of sense.
That's what that cold open is about Kevin McClory and him just like sticking with the rights and keeping the rights for Thunderball and Spectre and Blofeld.
Wow. Okay, and so I'm assuming this movie, Never Say Never Again, was released to challenge the official Bond film that was released, that like going head to head.
It was going head to head with Octopussy. Now, here's the thing. Roger Moore was kind of done with Bond movies, but then they found out that Sean Connery was making a rival James Bond movie the same year. And they were supposed to come out around the same time. And the producers were essentially like, "Hey, listen, people love you. You need to do this." Like, it's like, let's make sure that people know they're going to the right James Bond movie.
Right.
You know?
And oh my
so,
God.
Like the story goes, like Octopussy, it was like a huge deal that this was happening. And Octopussy was under a lot of pressure to perform.
Yeah.
And then this movie ended up getting delays and wasn't released until like later in the year, like in December, where Octopussy was like a summer release, and Octopussy made like so much more money than Never Say Never Again.
Yeah, it won. Oh, wow.
And then I think the subsequent years after Never Say Never Again, which was 1983, Kevin McClory just finally gave up for Spectre, which was, when was Spectre, 2015 or something?
Really?
The Daniel Craig ones, I kind of lose the years, but
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, he got his Bond movie. He got a Bond movie out of it. Yeah. So, you know, there's that. And he got Connery back. I mean, that's the OG Bond. That is, that's so fascinating.
I find it crazy that like two of these films were released in the same year. And I was kind of thinking, do you think at the time there was like this Bond fatigue, almost like we have like the MCU, for example, now? Do you think people were feeling that back in the day? Considering they were churning these out like every
year. Or like Solo coming out like 5 months after Last Jedi.
Yeah.
It could be.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, by this point, we'd already had so many parodies too, right? We'd had Top Secret and all of that, you know, and did
Top Secret was the following year.
Oh, was it? Okay. I wonder if there were any real spy spoofs back then. I mean,
I'm not sure when Spies Like Us came out. I'm not sure when that came out.
I'm not sure. But then, mind you, Casino Royale, the original, is in itself like a spoof, you know, and that
and
was long
Flint
before.
And the Flint movies and the, the Matt Helm movies and stuff. Like, yeah, but I think by the time the 80s came around, like, you weren't getting a ton of spy stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Bond was, like, still relevant. He's still out there making, like, a ton of money.
It was huge still. Yeah, yeah.
Also, this is, like... Okay, it's towards the end, but it's still kind of height of the Cold War era, where like this is all super relevant kind of stuff that's going on. So I'm not surprised people lapped it up, basically.
Yeah, for sure. Hannah, this is the first Bond that we've watched together, right? I guess
it is
in the film club.
So
it is, isn't it?
Yeah, I just feel like a really dry sponge, and every like fact y'all are like putting out, and putting it all in. I'm trying to hold the reality. It, in my brain at the same time, the fact that it was battling Octopussy, all of the drama behind, one, I love a petty queen, so was it Ian Fleming, and who's the other guy, Broccoli? Also, what are the names?
Yeah, Albert Broccoli, yeah.
Phenomenal.
His family are actually, like, were the inventors of broccoli. Like, his family.
Okay.
That's how they made their money. Was
honestly,
like,
love
I don't
them.
Know if it's
one
like
of my
great grandfather or something, but
nightshades or whatever they're called.
That's so funny. I always made it a point to call them broccoli because I didn't want them to sound like the vegetable, but they are actually the broccoli family.
Yeah.
Man, there you go.
So this is definitely my first one, first non-Daniel Craig film. But now, so the entire time I started wondering, so I rented online to view this film. And I kept waiting for a song. I kept waiting for the Down the Barrel because I was not aware of, all that came before it. So I was like, oh, this is odd. Not that, cause that's just so indicative of the universe you're going into. And I felt a little jarred to just jump right in. And then I was like, maybe they're going to do sequence after. I don't know. So for a while there,
right.
30 minutes, and I'm like, okay, it's not going to happen. So I got to stop waiting.
Yeah.
For it.
Yeah.
But
what's funny about the way you watched it is that like almost all the movie, like all the movies start with the gun barrel logo. But Daniel Craig's are all like, are the weird outliers where they stick it at the end. They stick it sort of in the middle. They're usually the very first thing you see after the MGM logo, with the exception of Daniel Craig's. I think the last two, I think Spectre and No Time to Die both start proper with the MGM logo and then the gun barrel sequence.
Was it to distinct, to make his films distinct? I wonder, why that, but
I think what happened was like the way they were presenting Casino Royale was here's James Bond. He's not 00 yet. So he doesn't earn that gun barrel shot. So once he kills that second guy in the sink and you see him shoot down the barrel of the gun, that's to say that's when he became 007. But
that's
then Mark Forrester and then Sam Mendes were like, well, we're going to put it then because we believe that's when he became 007. I'm like, stop. Put it at the beginning. I had a friend. You guys over in the UK usually get Bond movies before we do over in the States. And I have a friend who lives over there who is a massive Bond fan and will send me a DM saying they put the gun barrel at the beginning. Or they put the gun barrel at the end because it drives me nuts. Like it's supposed to be at the beginning. It's not in this movie. And what they did was this crazy 007 grid that flies into the into the frame, and it's really bizarre. It looks very 80s.
Mm-hmm. It sounds awful.
By a crazy dumb song.
Yes, there you go. Yeah, exactly.
I've read that they did make an opening credits for this film, but they decided to basically just not use it and then put the song over the like the opening training.
Really?
I wonder what the reason behind
it's
that.
It's probably
was.
McClure. It's either McClure like just being like, I need screw those guys. I'm not going to take anything from them.
Yeah.
Right. I've got Sean Connery. That's enough.
That's enough.
Or maybe he was afraid they would come after him if he did a similar format.
Mm-hmm.
Like that gun barrel logo is trademarked. So can't use that.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe he was probably afraid to do some sort of like, you know.
So there's like a lot of
silhouettes and stuff.
A lot of things I had to be aware of. I've been wondering now since y'all said it out loud that it's not a Bond film. How is there anything behind what the cast felt like? Like coming on, you know, Sean Connery was the Bond. Like, what's the vibe there? Do you feel like a pirate? How are you going?
Here's my line of thinking is that, there's a Bond movie with Sean Connery and the director of it is coming off of Empire Strikes Back. And like,
huge.
You're like, Kim Basinger was like not really anybody at the time. And I don't think a lot of these people are named people except for like Max von Sydow, Rowan Atkinson probably was doing like TV back then. Bernie Casey, who I think does a great job as Felix Leiter, was probably, I don't even know if he's well known now, but he's the principal in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure or the teacher. But it's one of those things where it's like, if someone were to approach me and say, hey, work on this unofficial Bond movie, in any capacity, and Sean Connery's going to be there, I'm going to be like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. We'll see how this goes.
Yeah. That's a stamp of approval in a way, or even authenticity. Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
And well, I mean, that leads us greatly then. Let's get into the cast and crew because it's kind of insane, I think.
It's nuts.
So, I mean, we can start from the cinematographer. So the cinematographer is Douglas Slocum. And I remember in the last episode as well, Ralph, you mentioned this. I had no idea who this guy was, but are you kidding me?
This is what he did between Raiders and Temple of Doom.
Come on. I mean, and coming off of an Oscar nomination for Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Well deserved.
I mean, yeah, that's absolutely mental. And I don't know. I mean, can you see it on the screen? I can't even really recall it.
It looks really 80s.
Yeah.
It looks really 80s.
Yeah.
Like, if you go and watch Octopussy, it looks like a classic James Bond movie. This looks so of its time. I don't know how Eon's able to do that. Like, there's 80s stuff in the 80s James Bond movies, but this...
Yeah, it's true.
It looks way more 80s than even, like, A View to a Kill, which is, like, 1985, Duran Duran. Like, yeah.
Yeah, this is...
I think some of my favorite shots and sequences in the films were kind of underwater, especially with like the shark attack scene. But
that was, I was just looking fucking out. Cool, man.
That wasn't even done by Douglas Slocum. They got someone else.
Rico
Browning.
Can't
find his name. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was it. They got someone else different completely to come and shoot those scenes.
Oh, really?
So Rico Browning is known for his underwater photography. He did Thunderball. He worked on Thunderball, but he also did all the underwater shots for Creature from the Black Lagoon, the classic Universal Monster movie. So it's like, even if he's not, you don't have a good, like, your cinematographer for your second unit, your underwater unit is like the top guy. This movie should be like the greatest movie ever.
It should be. Yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned that shark sequence because that was so impressive.
Yeah.
And guys, they clearly using a real shark here, right? I mean, that's a real shark.
Impressive, completely pointless, but impressive. I mean, I'm sure we'll get onto script in a bit, but yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, it's what you're saying there, Ralph, makes so much sense in a way, because the best thing about Thunderball, the original film, were those underwater sequences. I mean, incredible. Right. That's the highlight of the film. So the fact that it's the same guy, you know, behind it is, yeah, it makes a lot of sense because, yeah, that was very impressive. So, okay, so the composer is Michel Legrand, not Maurice Jarre, which I vehemently told Ralph on the last episode it was.
I tried to stop you. I tried.
Yeah. I dug a hole there for myself. But, I mean, kind of a massive composer. I mean, he won the Oscar for Best Original Song for Yentl, you know, and I remember Yentl. I remember the opening scene of Yentl is a beautiful, sweeping orchestral score. What happened in this film?
The music is so bad in this. It's really
terrible.
Bad, right?
Terrible.
Like, I warned you guys. My wife was like, what is happening in this movie? They're like playing jazz music and he's in like a motorcycle chase. A really good motorcycle chase. It's like, what is happening with this music? I think that the movie gets like one star down because of the music. Like the music.
I agree.
It's really bad.
I agree.
It's almost like he just picked up everything that was like he threw off on other projects and just like put it into this big mixing pot in this film.
But why? Yeah, because, okay, if you're going to go head to head with Eon, surely one of the things you have to nail is the composer. Surely.
Like Irving Kirshner could have got John Williams.
God. And correct me if I'm wrong, you probably know this story, Ralph, but didn't Spielberg want to make a Bond movie? And the Broccoli, absolutely. They said no?
The Broccoli said no. And so that's why the opening of Temple of Doom, Indiana Jones is wearing the suit from Goldfinger.
What?
Oh, that's...
Yeah.
That's a...
The black pants with the white jacket with the red flower. It's a carnation. It's exactly what Sean Connery wears at the beginning of Goldfinger. So I think it was probably Steven Spielberg's ego being like, here, I'll show them my James Bond movie. And that opening sequence of Temple of Doom is awesome.
It's incredible.
Yeah, look at the way Harrison Ford slides into that seat. Like you can picture it. Like it looks like James Bond at the beginning of Casino Royale. Or not Casino Royale, Dr. No.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. So it's...
See, knowing that film knowledge,
and I also heard,
fully enhances that watch.
Did you know that...
Yeah.
Did you know that Peter Jackson was up for Tomorrow Never Dies?
Stop it, no.
So Peter Jackson was up for Tomorrow Never Dies because he had some great movies under his belt. Barbara Broccoli, who's is the producer of Eon at the time, saw The Frighteners and said, never mind.
The Frighteners is awesome.
Yeah, but she didn't care for it.
She's not our guy.
Oh, wow. Wow. Okay, yeah. So they go with, who was it? Roger Spottiswood?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, what does a Peter Jackson Bond movie look like? Because I know he's a fan. I want to see that version. I wish Kevin McClory would have made his Thunderball remake in 85 and got Spielberg for that. Like I wouldn't like, but I mean, Spielberg got to work with Connery after that.
Years later. Right. So. And actually I'm glad they denied Spielberg because if he was so mad that he made Indiana Jones, then we all benefit from that, you know? And I'm pretty sure those Indiana Jones films would beat the Bond movies at the box office, at least Raiders for sure.
Well, here's the thing. Like, so if you look at Octopussy and this movie, which both came out after Raiders of the Lost Ark, you can see the influence. Like James Bond in these like catacombs at the end of this movie and stuff. Mm-hmm. Like, and then in Octopussy with, you know, him in India and like they do the sequence where there's wacky food at the table. You know, it's like straight up like, where what's his name eats the sheep's eye and stuff. It's like, that's straight out of, I guess Octopussy was before Temple of Doom. So maybe
they're all borrowing from each other.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, but very strange about Michel Legrand and
I'm just looking now at, you know, his repertoire of films he's worked on, and it's just really odd to me because he's worked on films like Cleo from 5 to 7 and The Umbrellas of Cherbourg, which are both beautiful films with like beautiful scores as well. But I would never picture them in a Bond movie. It just seems so ridiculous.
And the Thomas Crown Affair, I think, right? The original Thomas Crown Affair. I'm pretty sure he was the composer of that as well. Yes, he was.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, yeah. You know,
did
and he's
Bill
worked,
Conti
he's
do
worked,
the remake?
Say that again.
Sorry if I throw a wrench. I said, didn't Bill Conti do the remake?
Oh, with Thomas Crown Affair? With Brosnan?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to have to do. I'm going to have to know this.
Because he did the score for Your Eyes Only. He did that score. Bill Conti did that score, which I didn't really care for. It's weird when they bring these guys in, they just don't nail it. I think George Martin's was okay for Live and Let Die. But like Bill Conti, Marvin Hamlisch, Michael Kamen, Eric Serra, I think they all brought in like really weird takes on James Bond that don't quite connect.
Mm-hmm. You're right. It was Bill Conti who did the remake.
Yeah. That's so funny.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't care for his For Your Eyes Only either, except for the main theme. Main theme's awesome. I mean, I'm not even going to hum it because then we're fucked for the rest of our day.
To be honest, I didn't mind the main theme for this one. I thought the main Never Say Never Again song is like, it's quite
the one
nice.
Played at the end?
Never Say Never Again.
Yeah, there's an alternate version I heard once. There was a version that got rejected and it's like way better than both of the songs in this movie.
Oh, really?
And I'm like, you guys are making the wrong choices like every turn. Like,
I just think it suits the vibe of the film quite well because I feel, especially
80s.
Oh, yeah, that. And it just feels like maybe like a bit of a cheeky song. And like, I feel like that's the energy that Connery gives off in this film quite a lot.
Does this movie end with him winking? I watched it 2 weeks ago.
It does. Yeah.
There you go.
What does she say to him to get him to wink? She says
like never again.
Yeah, that's something.
And then he's
like,
never. I don't know what it was, but it was. I think it ends with never say never again, and then he turns to the camera and winks.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, yeah. You're right, Luke. Very cheeky. Very very cheeky. In terms of producers, I mean, it's not really. We kind of covered that. You've got Jack Schwartzman.
I mentioned that. Talia Shire.
Talia Shire?
Talia Shire is in there too. So Talia Shire played Adrian in Rocky. Her husband is Jack Schwartzman, and they worked on this movie. They also created Jason Schwartzman. So Jason Schwartzman's parents helped produce this movie.
And who's Jason Schwartzman? Is he
cousins of the Coppolas, aren't they?
Yeah. Jason Schwartzman from Rushmore. He's the main character in Rushmore, Wes Anderson's movie.
Oh, of course. Oh.
Yeah.
No way. Oh, shit. Hannah, did you say cousins of the Coppolas?
Yeah. Yeah.
What, as in Francis Ford Coppola?
Yes, like Sofia Coppola and all of them.
Is everybody fucking related to the Coppolas? I mean, I couldn't believe it, like, last year when I found out that Nicolas Cage is his... nephew. Yeah.
Him and Jason Schwartzman are cousins.
Yeah. Oh my word.
And Sophia and Roman and all those.
Sophia's
guys.
Niece now too, who's been making films. The whole
Yes, battle. Is it Gia or Gia Coppola?
Gia Coppola.
Whoever did The Last Showgirl, you know that new film, Pamela Anderson.
Gia.
That's a Coppola.
Yeah.
Wow, what a talented family. I wish I was.
And Roman Coppola is working with Wes Anderson on like his last several pictures, I think since Life Aquatic, and Jason Schwartzman's in all those.
Oh, wow.
There's a movie that Roman Coppola directed in 2002. I'm just going to put this out there. It's kind of it's a movie about making movies. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called CQ.
I have.
I love that movie.
Haven't seen it.
That movie. Oh, so I recommend it. You obviously, you guys love film. It's a movie about making movies. Jeremy Davies from Lost plays this guy, Paul, who's an editor working on a science fiction movie, like a low budget science fiction movie in like 1969 and 1970. While he's editing this schlocky movie, he's also trying to do his own personal film. He ends up getting like becoming the director of the crappy movie. It's really good. It's Roman Coppola. So you're going to get all the stuff like he did for Bram Stoker's Dracula, like all the cool effects and stuff, like the real practical effects. I've been told that it was too slow. I don't know anybody who's watched it and has been like, that movie's great. Me and my wife saw it for the first time back in 2002. And we just absolutely adore it. So if you want to see kind of a weird Coppola movie that nobody knows about, watch CQ. It's the letter C and the letter Q.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
It's like a Morse code. It's a Morse code.
That's great. If I may also suggest another unheard of Coppola film, Megalopolis. Please. I don't know if you heard that's worth a watch. No, sorry. That's great though. Yeah. I love.
Has anyone
X here? CQ.
And yeah, I'm glad you brought that up, Ralph. Yeah, because I remember reading about it and going, "This sounds awesome." Only a few months ago, and then it completely went out of my head. So.
Did you follow me on Letterboxd? Is that what happened?
I shall now.
It's in my top four solely because I like to just have it out there. I need to watch it. It's
yes,
I love it. It's a very slowly, deliberately paced movie, but I just absolutely love it.
Cool. We need to throw that into our film club rotation here then.
I have it up there.
Let's see it. You got a Blu-ray?
I don't think they released it on Blu-ray, but yeah.
That looks like cover.
That looks so 60s.
Yeah.
Yeah, it takes place in 1969. And so if you've seen like the spy movies like Modesty Blaze and Fathom and the Flint movies, it's kind of set in that timeline. Is there any fun
incredible.
Stuff in
oh, we got to get on this, man.
Yeah.
That sounds cool. Amazing.
Well, look at the cast. There's the cast. Jeremy Davies, Angela Linval, Gerard Depardieu, Billy Zane, Jason Schwartzman. And then Giancarlo Giannini, I believe, who plays Mathis in the Daniel Craig movies. He's also in this.
That awesome. Sounds really cool.
That sounds very, very cool. Have any of you been seeing these leaked, like, set photos of Billy Zane as Brando?
Yes.
No.
Obsessed.
Dude, what is going on?
I hope it's as good
wild.
As
that. Yeah. I mean, it's crazy. Oh, it's boy. Like he's back. Yeah.
I really do. I listen to this podcast about celebrity memoirs, and he constantly comes up, Marlon Brando.
Who, Zane or Brando?
No, Marlon Brando. So I've been so intrigued to get these snapshots from, old screen sirens who write a memoir or anybody else, but their mentions of what version of Brando they interact with and like where he is in his career. It's phenomenal. It's fascinating. It's so weird. So
Richard Pryor, what?
I heard that story. I think it might have been Francis Ford Coppola that mentioned something. I don't remember. There's something about Richard Pryor and Marlon Brando. And if I remember right, so this is just all hearsay, I guess, but I'm pretty sure I read it that they had an intimate encounter.
Mm-hmm. Intimate? Yeah.
Yes. And there was someone else too.
There was another, I remember hearing this in one of them. There was another man he was linked to.
Brando's wild, man. Like, his story is absolutely crazy. And I, you know, what you're saying there, Hannah, as well, like, at what point of his career do you, you know, where's he at any one time? Because I know, like, towards the end of things, wasn't he fucking done with acting? Wasn't he just like completely not giving a shit?
Yeah, earpieces. He would have earpieces. He would
cue cards.
But I love what he would say too about that. He'd be like, I just wanted to keep it fresh. So like I'm hearing the line for the first time and I'm just reacting and doing it. And like that's his version for not knowing his lines ahead of time or having cue cards.
Yeah, sure.
Phenomenal. Either way, I love how he spins things.
Yeah, he's fascinating. I mean, the behind the scenes of Apocalypse Now, and I remember reading a story once. That's, again, such a tangent. This is what happens with us, but it's fascinating. Did you ever see the movie? Is it called The Score? Robert De Niro and Edward Norton?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Brando is... Frank Oz directed it, yes. And Brando's in it very briefly, but apparently, and again, is it hearsay? I think it's pretty... Did you hear about this, Ralph?
Are you talking about the ending? Or the one of his shots?
One of his shots. And he hated Frank Oz and refused to actually speak to Frank Oz on set. So anytime Frank Oz was trying to give Brando direction, Brando would act like he couldn't hear him and he'd only speak to De Niro. And because Frank Oz also did a lot of puppeteering, wasn't he the voice of Yoda?
He performed like Yoda and Miss Piggy.
Miss Piggy. So he would say to De Niro, do you hear Miss Piggy? I hear Miss Piggy talking. Do you? I mean, that's the level of disrespect. And I think there was a scene between him and De Niro and, you know, Frank Oz was doing like these tight, you know, close-ups on each of them. And then he wanted to do a master to capture both of them in the scene. And Brando refused to let Frank Oz do the master. He said, we're not doing the master. You're in on De Niro. You're in on me. And that's it. Then we're out. And Frank was like, I'm the director of this movie. So he's telling De Niro, please tell Marlon that I want to do a master. So Marlon goes back to his trailer. And then after, you know, all this back and forth and hemming and hawing, he comes out and he's taken his pants off. So he's literally wearing nothing from the waist down. He might have his underwear on. And he comes back, he gets into position and he says, now do the master. I mean, like, wow. Just that is total.
I heard. That's a different story.
Oh, okay.
So he refused to, in his close-up, smile. He would not smile for the camera. And this is probably what, like late 90s, early 2000s. So Frank Oz was pretty much just like, fuck it. Like, we'll just shoot him just sitting there in bed. And then they digitally added a smile.
Stop it.
And you could see it online. It's so funny. Knowing that it's digital, it's so funny to look at.
Honestly, wow.
Forcing him digitally, yeah.
That's a true diva, if I ever heard of one.
Such diva
real
behavior.
Kevin McClory.
Wow, I love it.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Real McClory vibes. Oh, Jesus. Okay, so, all right, let's go to cast then. We've spoken about Connery. I mean, what else can you say about the guy? Mm-hmm. But the villain, Maximilian Largo, played by the actor Klaus Maria Brandauer. He's Austrian, I believe. He was in Out of Africa, but mostly it looks like a lot of Austrian movies. Actually, I say a lot. He was barely in a lot of movies. I think he was like a regular stage actor. I've got to say, really liked his performance.
Yeah, he was really good.
Yeah. And, you know, that's a real compliment because in these Bond movies, so many of these villains can sort of meld together. And I thought he was great. I really enjoyed the scene in this movie between him and Bond when they're playing that game, you know, that super 80s.
So dumb, yeah.
What the fuck is even going on this screen? How do you even play this thing kind of game? And the way the stakes just keep getting higher and higher with these electric shocks. I genuinely enjoyed the scene, though. I thought it was so well written. And the way Connery sort of gets...
I think the game design needed to be better.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. yeah, I mean, I don't know what's going on the screen. But I like the way Connery and this other guy, Largo, yeah, how they were playing it. And the first time Connery gets that shock and goes, oh, shocked me. And that just the grit, that the smug look on the other guy's face, but the not backing down. No, I'm gonna let's go again. You know.
Yeah.
And when it gets to the point where Connery Bond gets so shocked he falls off the chair, I was like, ooh, this is, you know, you don't really see the upper hand, you know, get held there with Bond too often. And I've got to say, there were a few times in this movie where Connery gets knocked down a peg or two.
It reminded me of in Casino Royale when Bond gets poisoned and has to go like revive his heart and stuff. And then he comes and just sits right back down at the table. Like it was that kind of thing.
That's a baller move. Yeah. Yeah. And
I agree with you that I think he's a really great actor. And okay. I think he's a very, very solid Bond villain. And I don't know if chemistry is the right word, but I think him and Sean Connery have a good chemistry on screen, but like in terms of tension that they're building between each other. But again, as I kind of alluded to before, I think he's just this character's kind of victim to what I think is a pretty poor story and pretty poor script.
Sure. Yeah. Which is why actually it's even more impressive that his performance comes through.
Yeah,
and
when
I read that he was a stage actor, I was like, there it is. I mean, he's making a meal of everything and he's finding all this business. He's finding such life in these really generic lines, you know? And so, yeah, super, super impressive. And on that same note, his sidekick, Fatima Blush, played by Barbara Carrera. I loved her in this.
Yeah.
I thought she was great. She's from Nicaragua. She is having a blast. She's having so much fun. And the energy she brings to it, I'm like, yes, go for it.
Yeah, I felt
she is
super
great.
Impressive.
And she's incredibly beautiful and she's so much fun. But again, they do her so dirty with how they kind of get rid of her in the film. And it's just really frustrating. It's like she wants Bond to write down, that she's the best lover he's ever had. It was just so... Like, it's Bond and it's going to be silly, but this was like just almost hard to watch for me. It was just so dumb. But
yeah. How many times in the entire Bond franchise have they got Bond? They've got him. Pull the trigger. Like, do something. But they'd wait and they expound on their entire plan or they just keep talking.
That's basically their downfall. Every movie.
Every movie, yeah. Like even up to the very last one. They don't know when to shut up these Bond villains. But yeah.
But would it feel odd? Would it feel like a Bond film if you don't have it? Just like you don't get the barrel.
Yeah.
It's true. Yeah, no, it's true. It's an endearing thing, I guess, by the time you get to this.
Yeah.
But with this one as well. Sorry, Ralph, you go.
I was going to say, I think it's fun because, like, within the world, a lot of times people are aware of Bond. Like, clearly, Bond is famous, and she's like, well, if James Bond says I'm the best lover, then, like, I'm going to get all kinds of dudes or whatever. I don't know.
Worst secret agent in the world, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I feel like all of these villains are so arrogant. And they're like just reveling in the fact that they capture James Bond. And they like really want to tell him. Like it's like it's like an arrogance thing.
Yeah.
But it does happen in, I believe, every single movie.
That checks out.
Yeah,
I like that reasoning.
It's like,
I like that. It's true.
You know, everyone knows who James Bond is, right? So yes, like you said, Luke, the worst secret agent in the world. But they never clock on to the fact that this guy has gadgets. This guy has a Q. You know, like, remove everything from
Le Chiffre,
him, even a pen.
Le Chiffre figured it out. Strip him naked and go to town.
There you go. Are we talking about Casino Royale, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Again, quite another baller move to laugh in that moment. I mean, Jesus. I can barely remember it, but
yeah.
We'll get to it. It'll probably be in 3 years, but we'll get to it. Okay, Max von Sydow as Blofeld. What a waste of a hell of an actor.
He's barely in the movie. He's barely in
it. You've got Max von Sydow. Use him.
Yeah, it's a hard one. Definitely wasted.
The only thing I could think of, is they got him for a day. Mm. And Kevin McClory was probably like, well, if we can get him on our movie as Blofeld, that's going to be a big deal.
Yeah, but maybe, yeah.
That's the only thing I can think of.
Right, exactly. That's the only thing. Right, right. Yeah, because, I mean, he, like you said at the start of the call, he's still Von Sydow by this point. He's not an unknown, right? I mean, the guy's always just been old to me. You know, he's like Morgan Freeman. I've just always imagined he was always old. But yeah, by this point, I think he was still... Because he's from Sweden, right? Is it Sweden?
Yeah, he had been in The Exorcist and The Seventh Seal.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Like, he's
oh, yeah.
well known. The same year he did, in 1983, he did Strange Brew. He was the main villain in Strange Brew. He gave Strange Brew, the Mackenzie Brothers movie, more time than he did this James Bond movie.
Never
like,
seen,
have you
it.
Seen Strange. You haven't seen Strange Brew? You know it, but do you kind of know, like, do you know the Mackenzie Brothers, Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas? SCTV.
Yeah.
They did a sketch show called SCTV.
Yes,
Second
heard of
City
it.
TV. And
John
they
Candy
these
and all
Canadians.
That, right?
Yeah, yeah. And they play these Canadians that have a show called The Great White North. And they made a movie based on those two characters. And it's one of my favorites growing up. And Max von Sydow plays the main villain in it.
Okay. I need to see this.
I'm loving this.
See this.
I mean, it's so much fun. It's one of my favorite movies.
Oh, excellent. All right. I tell you, you see what happens with this guy? Like, the list that you come out of.
I'm so old. I know all the old stuff.
You're aware. I'm old too, but I'm not always aware.
Who else is really of note here? I mean, Kim Basinger, of course. I mean,
early career.
Jesus Christ. That's a stunner right there. Very early. Kind of annoying how the whole massage scene. I mean, he pretends to be a masseuse. And it's quite creepy because he's so much older than her, right?
But of course she loved it.
But she loved it. She loved it. Of course she did.
She was creeped out for a second. Like, wait, yeah. Who are you? And then was like,
Yeah. Gives a little smile. Yeah. Oh, my God.
That's very Sean Connery, James Bond.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Doesn't he? And before that, he walks into the spa area and every single woman is just like,
Yeah.
Is, you know, it's just, yeah. You just see a room full of 15 women all just fawning over him. It's, oh boy, yeah, par for the course. what did you guys think of Kim Basinger? I mean, I thought she was fine. I don't really, in terms of performance-wise, nothing really stood out to me.
I think she was fine. She was fine as a Bond girl. Like, she wasn't really playing a damsel, but also she doesn't really play this like strong heroine that they kind of had started to push into the Bond girl a bit by this point. I would say a bit forgettable.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's hard to hold her to account for that.
Although I guess she does technically save the day for some reason when she's like in the scuba gear at the end and she for some reason she was there. They decided to take her along.
Good, yeah, just give us something to do. Yeah.
No, she's static.
Okay, cool, yeah.
Can't do anything about that.
5 years later, she was in Batman? That's so weird to think.
Oh, she...
It was only 5 years later she was in Batman. So her career must have really launched from this movie.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Wow, I didn't realize. What, was she in the Michael Keaton, what, the first one?
Yeah, the 89.
Oh, shit. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I didn't realize that.
Vicky Vale.
Ah,
see her.
Yeah, it must have done then. Yeah, because she was, I guess she was a relative unknown in this. But yeah, I mean, again, yeah, if you were to, I know it's not official, but look at the roster of Bond girls. I mean, yeah, stunning. Then you have Bernie Casey playing Felix Leiter. You know this actor, Ralph, yeah?
A little bit. He's the teacher in Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Passed away a couple years ago. But I really liked his Felix Leiter. I really did. I'm a fan of when Felix Leiter's kind of a younger guy who is kind of like the American version of James Bond. Like he's like the CIA, he's like the coolest CIA guy. I don't like when he's like just like an old man in a fedora and he's just like,
you know,
like I like that. Like he should be James Bond's friend. Like these guys should be able, like have gone out on the town like several times and they like know each other. Like they've been doing stuff. And I feel like Bernie Casey does do that in this. Like he's real comfortable with Bond.
Oh, cool. Nice. Yeah, I didn't really notice him. I guess he didn't really stand out too much for me in this. But that's interesting. What are you saying, Luke?
I was going to say, I kind of feel like they didn't really know what to do with him in this film.
Right.
Even though I agree that he was pretty good. For example, the scene after when he kills Fatima Blush and he's kind of just been... James Bond has just kind of been held captive by her. He just like walks from the background. It's like, oh yeah, I've been here the whole time.
yeah. I did think to myself, too, gonna help out.
Yeah. Like he knew Bond had it well enough to know. Yeah. You know, like you know what, he'll probably be fine. But I want to see how this plays out. I want to see the man. I want to see the man cook.
right. When you look at this guy's credits, though, wow, he was in Boxcar Bertha, Scorsese's second film. He was in what did I just see? Obviously, Never Say Never Again. But yeah, like you said, Ralph, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. He was in another 48 Hours. The second film by Walter Hill, Under Siege with Steven Seagal, Revenge of the Nerds 3. He was in the original as well, Revenge of the Nerds, which again I haven't seen. You guys seen it?
Yeah.
He was also in Black Gun, I've just seen, which is actually one of the first blaxploitation films I ever saw and was recommended in Tarantino's book.
Oh, definitely sweet.
Worth a watch. Yeah.
Oh, nice. Nice. Cool, yeah. And then, I mean, really, the only other actor of note is Rowan Atkinson. Shocking. I couldn't believe he was in this. I love him. I grew up...
And you didn't know he was in... Oh, that's... I wish I hadn't spoiled it for you last week. I really wish.
I'm so shocked.
I messed it up.
Yeah.
And, oh, no, I feel bad.
Growing up, Mr. Bean was a... staple in my life. And I'm so curious how do you guys feel about him? Because people blow hot or cold on him and that character of Mr. Bean.
Oh.
I had him all on VHS.
Yeah.
Nice.
I grew up with him. Everyone in Brazil really likes him too.
Oh.
So my mom loves him. I grew up watching him like dubbed over in Portuguese in Brazil and then back here in the States anyways. And occasionally we'll like watch a few of the clips and like kind of have like a laugh.
I love that because so many of my cousins who are Portuguese, they don't speak English, love him. I love how that his physical comedy, Mr. Bean, it can translate across the world.
It's so universal. Yeah.
Yeah.
I absolutely love him. I grew up watching him all the time. And I had like, I got for Christmas one year, it was like, you know, his little brown briefcase that he had. Carries around with him.
Yeah.
It was like this little brown briefcase, but with all the DVDs of all the TV shows inside.
Oh.
And also had the little brown teddy in as well.
Oh, that's such a good
one. Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Did it have the button? Was it missing the button?
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's
very cool. Yeah.
I love him in this film as well. He basically just plays Mr. Bean, but with, you know, he just happens to be like this. This like English diplomat
and he's putting this accent on. I don't know what it is, but he's hilarious. And yeah, I wish again they made more use of him. I don't know if he was big at this point. Was he
definitely not in the States?
Uh-huh.
They may have showed Blackadder on like PBS, our public broadcasting station, and
this was at the time of Blackadder, like Blackadder 2, maybe. Year.
You know what? The Blackadder was only a year in. when this film came out. The film came out 3 years before Blackadder 2. So yeah, I guess he wasn't big yet in that sense.
I could see like Irving Kirshner being in London shooting Empire Strikes Back and it being on TV and him just being like, get that guy. I'm going to get that guy for my next thing.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
I was going to say, it's funny.
Yeah. Oh, I love it. And I just love the,
sorry, go ahead.
What were you going to say? I think we were about to say the same thing.
Love for Rowan. I was going to say, I think it's why I didn't know that he was connected in this way to like Bond in some form. So then when he does Johnny English,
right.
Really full circle. And then some for me.
So I've never seen Johnny English, but I want to. And the reason is because the writers of the Johnny English movies wrote the Pierce Brosnan in some of the Daniel Craig movies. Purvis and Wade.
Shit.
That's so rad.
Oh,
and also so funny to be the writer of the actual thing that it's spoofing.
Right.
But then, because you know how ridiculous it is. Like, we haven't gotten really to like the meat or the overall of Never Say Never Again. But one of the things that struck me the most is just, I didn't know about any of this drama that you're giving me. All these other ways, all these other lenses to see this film. But I thought it was such a hoot. Like, y'all talking about the music, and I was like, the music was hysterical. I was like, wow, I didn't know Bond could do this. And now knowing the context, phenomenal. But I'm really glad that I didn't know the drama behind it, because I think I had a very different viewing experience than you guys going into it.
Yeah. Oh, great.
It definitely hits different when you watch them all in order and you get to this one.
Yes.
Like there's the stuff that's omitted from this that's in the Eon Productions is very, very like in your face. You're like, oh, something's not right. So for you seeing it like after just seeing the Craigs, it's probably a better experience for you.
It was for genuinely sure. Hysterical. I hadn't laughed out loud at other movies like this recently, but in genuine, like not laughing at it exactly, but I felt like I could laugh with it because I felt like it was sort of like winking at me the whole time. I don't know how to describe it, but yeah, I like loved it. I thought it was just so cheeky and sort of camp for someone.
Totally.
It's just.
Speaking of which.
Yeah, it's just.
The writer of this movie also not only wrote the Flash Gordon movie from like 1980, the one with Max von Sydow, but also wrote or maybe even created the 1966 Adam West Batman.
Oh my word. Lorenzo Semple Jr. And he did. Oh, this guy's a massive writer. Ralph, he did the Green Hornet as well. And oh my God, that's insane. I mean, Papillon, 3 Days of the Condor, the Parallax View. What? That's
this
wild.
This movie should be better. This movie should be so
it
good.
Should be. It should be better. Yes.
But he does do camp. He does do camp. And this falls in that category of like Batman and Flash Gordon for sure.
Damn. Incredible. King Kong from 1976.
Ooh,
who did that one?
I like that movie.
Yeah?
I know that Dino De Laurentiis produced it. Look at the cast of that movie.
John Barry did the Bridges. Score. Oh my God. Wait. All of this. So
Charles Grodin.
John Barry did the score.
Yes. It's an amazing
Jeff
score.
Jeff Bridges, Charles Grodin, Jessica Lange. Oh.
Jessica Lange's first feature. Yeah. My Mothra. I have my Mothra hoodie on. I forgot there's also that dumb knowledge I have in my brain.
There's another one. Yeah, there's another one. Wow. Okay.
I highly recommend it. It's a straight up remake. But the like listen to the Barry score whenever you get a chance. It's so good. I have it on vinyl. I might go pop it on.
Ooh, lovely. Lovely. Oh, I need to do that. Because yeah, that's the thing, Hanu, is when you go through all the Bonds, you know, if you love film music like we do, you realize Barry's the MVP of the entire franchise. So you get to this oddity and you're like, what am I hearing? You know, Hannah shared an image in our group last week of the screenshot of, does he open his suitcase and there's like an entire picnic perfectly proportioned, like in their little, you've got sauces. Bond. Is it Rowan Atkinson or Bond?
No. It's Bond when he's at the spa, when he's at like the health clinic.
Oh, yes.
Foie gras and vodka in his suitcase.
It's so beautiful. Here it is.
Yeah.
It's just so perfect.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right. None of that stuff fell or moved.
No, it's so perfectly placed. Yeah.
It's perfect. The fact that he's in a wellness center in the 80s is so funny to have that strongly come back in our age, too. I was just like, is this speaking to my time? What's happening? How do they know?
Yeah.
Oh, all of it is so wacky.
Absolutely ludicrous. And then finally it brings us on to Irvin Kershner, the director, coming straight off of The Empire Strikes Back. Ralph, he directed RoboCop 2.
RoboCop 2. And it's
any good? Oh.
It's almost as if Empire Strikes Back is an anomaly for Irvin Kershner, because there's just something off about everything. I don't know how he nailed Empire Strikes Back so perfectly.
Interesting. And
did you watch RoboCop? Did you end up watching RoboCop yet?
Not yet. Okay. Not yet.
This is not the right time. I get it. Do lights down.
Yeah.
Surround or whatever the best sound you can get. And
dude, do you know the amount of shit I've been getting from people after that episode? One of my colleagues came into work the other day and just looked at me and went, Conan the Barbarian, RoboCop, Starship Troopers. He was like, you need to stop. He said, before you get to the art house stuff, he said, do the foundations first. I was like, just give me a break, dude.
Did you listen to those scores?
I did listen to some of them. Yeah, not all, but I was, especially when I was looking for the tracks to use. Awesome.
Yeah.
Actually, that Conan score, dude, that's Total Recall. That's the opening of Total Recall.
Yeah. Yeah. Basil Poledouris worked a lot with like John Milius and Paul Verhoeven. And Jerry Goldsmith did Total Recall. And I want to say that Paul Verhoeven said he wanted it to start off like stronger and gave him Conan. And he just like used Conan. Like he was just like, okay, here. Like it's exactly the same.
The rest
of the score is like brilliant, but. It is funny that it is one for one. The opening of Conan theme is the opening of Total Recall.
Amazing. Yeah. All right. Well, that takes us through casting credits. Do you know the funny thing? In a regular film club, that takes 10 minutes. But I guess,
your everything you guys talk about. Like, I didn't bring up that in the wellness center that the fight that he fights with that big giant guy is Pat Roach, who was the Nazi who gets sucked into the airplane in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh, shit.
And he's also in Temple of Doom. He gets crushed by the rock crusher. And he's also in, I forget who he is in Last Crusade, but he's in like all of.
Oh, that's so cool. I have to say, what a fight.
It's a good fight.
What a fight sequence.
Does one of them literally say like James Bond's urine? One of the jars?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, with like tape, right?
Yeah. And what does he do?
Because he like throws it at him and then he
in his face and then he dies. Yeah. I mean, I guess that's the joke.
Yeah.
Maybe
he's just got really toxic urine, who knows.
Well, I guess is it meant to be because he drinks so much? I don't know.
I have no idea.
I mean overall we can just go around and, but I mean I'll say it's not a good movie. It's not a good movie. I enjoyed moments of it. There is still, and this probably happens with every Bond film, there's something to enjoy It gets me through to the end. You know, I roll my eyes, I shrug my shoulders at times, but it's fun. And I'll happily never watch it again, I guess, but I'm glad I did. Ralph, what do you think overall?
For me, it is, I think, as enjoyable, if not more enjoyable, than Thunderball. I think it's just missing those elements. I mean, the music really drops it down. But it's one, you know, like if you get past the no gun barrel and you get past the music, like there's some great shots in here. I think the motorcycle chase is amazing. I think the horse jumping off of the fortress is dumb and it doesn't look good. And then they throw a real horse into the water. I'm like, what is happening?
Did they kill that horse?
I don't think they killed the horse. I think horses could swim.
They can.
But that one special effect where they're falling off and it looks like a cutout of them is so bad.
Yeah.
I think for the most part, it's fine for someone else to do. And that's what I'm afraid of with Amazon taking over the rights for the series. I'm like, they need to get back Purvis and Wade to write it. They need to get David Arnold. They need to get Ray Fiennes and all those guys. Just make it feel comfortable. Like, I don't know if you guys noticed this, but at the beginning of Honor Majesty's Secret Service, the cold open has a scene with Moneypenny, Q, and M, which they really don't show up in cold opens ever. And it was just the way to let the audience know, like, hey, listen, this is the same. We have John Barry music. We had the gun barrel. At the beginning, it says Harry Saltzman and Albert R. Broccoli present. Like, they're, like, letting the audience know, listen, it's the same old gang. It's just the one guy, the main guy is different. So I'm hoping when Amazon does their next one that they're like, we'll get as many of those people as we can get together so that people can ease into this new era. Cause that's all I want.
My guess is that that's definitely not going to happen. I think they're
going to have hope.
A complete refresh, I think. I mean, I might be wrong, but yeah.
Maybe. I was just going to say, yes, exactly that, Ralph, what you were saying, beginning of On Her Majesty's Secret Service. And then I love the, because he's driving, right? And then he sees a beautiful woman on a beach. And then he goes to engage with her and just gets attacked by some dudes, fights them off, turns to the camera, looks down the camera and says, this never would have happened to the last guy. That's when you're like, the boldness.
That's the thing, it's like, don't take it so serious.
Yeah,
can I just tell you who I want, what I want for the next James Bond movie?
Please.
To really just like, okay, so here's who I want to play M in the next James Bond movie. Pierce Brosnan.
Okay.
Just do it. Continuity was never a thing in these movies.
That's true.
Until Daniel Craig.
That's true.
It never mattered. There was an actor who's a bad guy in Living Daylights, who two movies later is a good guy in GoldenEye. There's a good guy in You Only Live Twice, who in two movies later is Blofeld. Like, it's like, just...
Yeah.
Like, it never mattered. It never mattered. Maude Adams plays two different characters, like, with Roger Moore. Roger Moore slept with Maude Adams as two different characters as James Bond.
Jesus.
And only like three movies apart. So it's like one of those things where it's like, like if you can just show the people like, hey, listen, we're getting back to, it doesn't have to all be interconnected. It doesn't have to be a through storyline. Let's get back to just like, these are individual stories. They don't really relate to each other.
Yeah. I guess quickly, you could ask everybody, who do you want as Bond? Any thoughts?
No. No thoughts.
You guys don't have any thoughts?
I played around with it a while ago.
I have a theory.
My friends who like love Bond, but again, I have not interacted with it much at all these years.
Just don't say him.
Okay.
Bond is cast. I hesitate when people are fan casting a younger Bond. Something, especially after watching Sean Connery. I like that. And I just overall in culture anyways, I like continuing to have older actors and actresses be able to take on these roles in these huge films again. Some of it's also like, you know, what if you didn't have that level of fame? Is that going to destroy you later on? Doesn't seem like any, you know, some folks
get. Sean Connery was an unknown.
Yeah, like, I think that's phenomenal. Mm. Like right now with, I'm totally blanking on his name, the gentleman from White Lotus season 3, and he's also in Fallout.
Oh, Walton Goggins?
Yes. I feel like Walton Goggins is having big moments these past like 2 years, couple of years. And like, I want somebody who is seasoned in their craft to take on the role, be a bit of an unknown, or just also any of these other, like, I really enjoyed when people were throwing around Idris Elba and some other folks. I thought that was quite exciting.
Yeah. I think he's aged out by this point.
That's the
thing. Looking for like a 35-year-old now. Yeah. So that they can be in
a couple more
movies for at least 10 years.
Really taxing this role.
Can you imagine Walton Goggins as Bond and him trying to do the British accent? That would be Yeah.
I agree I think they should really go for what they kind of did with Craig, and I'm basically just repeating what you said, Hannah, where it's like someone who's they're starting to build their repertoire of films, but no big names, because for example, if they were to cast Henry Cavill, just as an example, that's to me, that's Henry Cavill. That's Superman. Not
it's yeah. Superman, yeah.
Yeah.
That's,
yeah.
Superman. We want someone who we can like really
He's done it in Mission Impossible.
As James Bond. Yeah.
Exactly. Right. There you go. Yeah. I had a wild thought the other day about this guy.
Oh, that young
George guy. McKay.
Oh, they've been throwing his name around.
Oh, have they? That. Oh, so yeah, I'm not. Okay. I thought I was going to be unique in that. Fine.
Or Chris should be in casting, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah. But there you go. Yeah.
I think Ralph, George McKay would be good, yeah, because they
I think
want
so.
To like
young enough.
They maybe we talked about that last time, but they want to kind of explore the earlier part of James's life, like
when he was in the war,
army or something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, that would be yeah be a awesome. Very interesting yeah. take. Yeah.
Yeah,
and then again though, but then does that feel like a Bond film? Like when mentioning in Casino Royale, they don't do the barrel until he's gotten his second shot. I like that. Understanding of it. It's not a Bond until that transformation. So it would be phenomenal to see.
But I think, yeah, and I think if Amazon are trying to do like something fresh and trying to reinvent it, that's like a really good way to go about it, I think. It's really like
but
fleshing
it's lasted,
out.
But it's lasted over like 60 years.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you can't mess with it too much. Well, I mean, that's coming from a.
Also, it's inevitable, isn't it? It's Murphy's Law. It's inevitable that at one point they're going to turn up big. They're gonna take a big step in one direction.
But I mean, Eon did that too. Like, if you look at, like, I don't know, like A View to a Kill. Good luck next week, guys. if you look at, or whenever you watch it next.
Yeah.
But there's certainly like Die Another Day is a massive miss for the franchise. Oh. Like there's bad James Bond movies. Yeah. But my pick for James Bond, I don't think anybody else has thought of this. Maybe I'm sure someone has.
What's throw that? It up, throw it up, a photo.
Oh, should I throw up a photo?
Can I throw up a photo? Because it'll be audio.
Okay, I'll do both. Oh, my cellular data just turned off because I'm...
See your cellular data?
My Bluetooth headset tries to connect to my phone. Okay, I'm going to do this as fast as I can. We'll see. Okay, brightness. Okay.
Have you been brewing on this for a while, this casting choice?
This person posted an Instagram story recently where I'm like, that dude is charming. And I would love to see him as James Bond. And I think, like...
he's going to put a picture of me up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's going to be... So for a while there was talk of... Danny Boyle was supposed to do a Bond movie. He was supposed to do No Time to Die, but apparently it was too lighthearted for Eon, so they kind of passed on his version. And so, like, a lot of people have been throwing this name of Aaron Taylor Johnson around because he's worked with him. But when it comes to people who worked with Danny Boyle...
Ah, oh, Dev Patel?
Dev Patel as James Bond.
And we know he can do action from Monkey Man, which is awesome.
Did you say awesome?
Yeah, Monkey Man. Yeah, was it called was Monkey it? Man?
Yeah,
yeah, Monkey, yeah, Monkey Man. Man. I need to watch it. It's sitting on my Apple TV.
He did Green cool, Knight. Cool. Him and Green Knight.
Did you hear her reaction? Oh my gosh!
From one female's perspective.
Yeah. So I feel like. I mean, it would be.
I want to know why. Yeah. Why Ralph? And I my reaction is because he's
it was literally one. It was. He posted a Instagram story where he was talking about his Mini Cooper that he has, and he was going on and on and on about it. And he was so charming. He was just so charming. And I'm like, man. And for me, anytime I see any actor with a British accent, I'm like, would they be able to play Bond? And when I saw him, I was like, oh my God, he's so charming. Yeah. And then I saw the trailer for Monkey Man and I'm like, okay, he does action and he can do that stuff. And I think I'm just like, if you're going to shake it up, let's get depth. Like I think there are people out there who brought it up.
I think he's got such a really interesting career, his path. Starting off with Skins.
For sure.
Insane that they cast any kids in those shows ever. That's insane to me. It does not seem, the right pick or kosher. But him in Green Knight, him in Monkey Man, even the he did a short with Amazon. He's already worked with Amazon once. So I wouldn't be surprised if he was far out there on the radar. But he has so many depths to him. So Daniel Craig, I think now post-Bond is where we get to see him perhaps take on some lighter roles and kind of really stretch himself out. But with Dev Patel, I've already seen some examples of his range. And I think that'd be quite interesting. Right. I feel like whatever they would throw at him, it would be he would bring a layer of depth. I know he is young, but I feel like his experience.
He's the age they were looking for. They were looking for someone 36, which I believe was the age of Daniel Craig when he started.
That's wild. Just because of Daniel Craig's face, he always gives older to me.
And physique as well. Yeah, he always is, Daniel Craig.
His high-waisted pants.
Is he the beefiest Craig the Bond they've ever had? Everybody else is pretty svelte.
The beefiest? Probably. Right?
Yeah.
Probably.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Connery was a scrappy guy, but he was never built like
And Pierce Craig. They're quite
live
figures.
It's a very
Aaron
interesting
Taylor Johnson
choice.
Who I also was hoping for. Mm-hmm. He is also 34 and he's a good looking dude.
He's definitely handsome.
He's very good looking.
Very physically capable.
I have a personal vendetta.
Yes.
He fired my mum.
Who?
So, Aaron Taylor Johnson. Yeah, because she wouldn't work at Christmas. Yeah, this is the first and last time we mention his name on this thing. But no, it is an interesting choice. And I will say this, if Bezos himself does not play a Bond villain by the final one, then they're missing the biggest opportunity ever.
He's like a massive fan, right? Like he's a huge Bond fan. That's why they own Bond.
That's crazy to me. Sorry, actually, unrelated. But I was gonna say, it's so
you
funny.
Think he would see? You think he would see? Right?
I was like, don't you see that you are the villain, bro? I love that. I was like, you're burning up the planet and resources for this 24-hour crime shit. I was like, you are literally the bald, bad, evil man.
Just give him a white cat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe he'll try cast himself as James Bond and just be the most expensive vanity project in history.
Oh, I'd watch anyone beat the crap out of him. I'd watch anybody just go to town on him and just give him an exploding pen.
Please. I'll make it real. But I'm just kidding. Sorry.
All right. So let's do ratings then. So going round, I'll start with you, Hannah. What would you rate Never Say Never Again?
So, Ralph, I have to say this because the rating has been interesting for me so far this year, and I'm trying to keep reminding myself how I've rated other films we've done this year. So I cannot rate it any higher than a 1, but I gotta say I had a joyous time is the thing. I genuinely I love the underwater shots. I know it doesn't really like serve a purpose, some of those things, but I had such a blast watching it. And then I was confused. Then I was like, this doesn't seem to like be on par with what I would anticipate from Bond, especially recognizing that Sean Connery had been Bond beforehand. But still hit a lot of these notes that I think are just like cheeky. They're iconic for a reason. But I enjoyed it. But as Chris said too, I don't see myself revisiting it. But maybe for like, they make so many digs at him. Also the fact that they're like, he's too old. I was like, is this all a huge comedy bit? I was like, is this just like an extended SNL skit? Because it's so silly. It really is. But I did enjoy it in multiple parts. So maybe if I need another good chuckle or something.
Brilliant. Okay. So one from you. But that's fine. Yeah, I'm glad you had a good time though, for sure. That's all that matters.
Yeah. I mean, have you put it off for so long for us to talk about it? Because I was like, I have to at least send this one screenshot of his beautiful quail eggs, caviar, vodka. Like, who put that together even, you know, at the back end headquarters?
Exactly. He's nothing if not prepared. The thing is, it doesn't even come into use in any sort of gadget. But there's no trick to it. It is purely his dinner, his lunch, whatever the fuck it is. Yeah.
There should be martini glasses with martini in it.
Yeah.
Like, then, oh, another. Just like, maybe they said no martini glasses in this one. We also own that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's my.
What about you, Ralph?
Okay. So I've said that this has been growing on me and that I rate it higher than Thunderball. I'm on my letterbox just to see where I put Thunderball. First of all, I've reviewed Thunderball 6 times. And I started Letterboxd like sometime during COVID lockdown.
Can't get enough of it? What's happening?
I watch these movies a lot. I watched it. I just keep watching them on a loop. My wife watches Gilmore Girls. Usually when that starts up, I start doing my Bond
rewatch. It's like a seasonal watch.
I watched Never Say Never Again. I watched that 2 weeks ago. And then we finished up the season 7 of Gilmore Girls like earlier this week. So we have kind of a similar timeline. For some reason, because here's the thing, I'm going to say this and you don't have to apologize to me if you don't like something or whatever. Like the Bond films, I get it. I have a friend who's watching them for the first time and he's like, these are boring. And I'm like, I get it. Someone will say, I hate this movie. And I understand that even though it might be my favorite, I can, or the opposite. If someone says like, I love Tomorrow Never, or I love Die Another Day, I'm like, bottom of my list, but that's fine. It's whatever. I'm just glad people are watching them. Mm-hmm. But for some reason, I gave Thunderball 4 stars.
Wow.
And I don't know why.
Hi.
I don't know why it is. Well, here's the thing. I think the lowest one, I think, is Die Another Day, and it has like 2.5 stars. Like my bond like rating is not, nobody would ever give these movies anything. Luke was saying last week that like that Casino Royale was his only 5-star movie. Do I have like 3 that aren't 5-star, like of the 25?
I love
these movies. I am going to say though, realistically, because of the music, because it's not Eon, and what they were able to do, I would give this 3.5 stars.
Sweet.
I think that's for me. Sweet. I think that's fair.
Fair enough. Luke?
Yeah, I think I'm pretty much in the same boat as you, Chris. Like, there are elements of the film that I actually think are pretty damn good. And you're absolutely right. Like, it's an entertaining film, and I happily watch it to the end. The biggest issue that I have with the film is that I think the story is a whole load of nonsense. Just as an example, the whole Bahamas part at the start is just so dumb. He literally gets there, meets the Bond girl, and then fucks off to Nice. It's just, to an extent, felt like they were making it up and writing it as they were just going along.
It's nonsense. For sure.
Yeah, it's nonsense. And I agree.
It almost feels like that like Kevin McClory had to have a certain amount of things in his script to be a Thunderball remake, and he's like, well, I really don't want to go to the Bahamas again, but I'm like contractually obligated to, so here's this scene. Like, it feels like that.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, 100%. I agree. The music's pretty naff, But, you know, overall, like I said, I had a pretty good time. So I think this is actually kind of generous for a lot compared to a lot of my Bond ratings, but I'll probably give it a 2.5.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah, actually, I'm going to say...
Wow.
2 weeks ago, I gave it 4 stars on Letterboxd.
4 stars.
I gave it 4 stars.
So now you're going to have to go back in and drop it.
I'll leave
half
it.
No. Star.
The next time I watch it, every time I watch it, like, it depends on my mood as well.
Yes.
Like,
indeed.
I could watch,
yes.
Like, and I think the last time I watched Thunderball was in a really good mood and was like, yeah, this is great. James Bond, whatever.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
3 hours I've got of to say, swimming, no problem.
Yeah. And if it looks as beautiful as that, I mean, yeah. And those short shorts that Connery is wearing in Thunderball. Oh man, it's easily identifiable for sure. You never get lost in who's who in that underwater scene. I would say for me, it's going to be same as Luke, 2.5. And I think I gave the exact same rating to Thunderball. And I can't tell you why it's the same rate. It makes no sense.
I feel like the villain performances are better, but the story's worse.
There you go.
And the writing's worse.
Yes.
The music is the stunt sequences and the underwater stuff is like better in this, but like it's just everything else is like other stuff is like worse. Like it doesn't have like what you're looking for. It's not that they're the same, like they just add up to the same.
Yes, that's it. I think they kind of, what one loses, another gains. It kind of balances each other out. Yeah, for
like
sure.
The scale.
For sure. Yeah.
The scale, yeah. You're like, oh, well, there's too much going for this freaking movie. Never Say Never Again. So let's take off the music. And then it's like starting to balance out. It's like, okay, well, yeah. It's
exactly
that.
But it makes me excited to go from this to A View to a Kill because I think Barry's back, right?
Barry's back. He collaborated with the artist to do the main theme, which is Duran Duran.
Awesome. And, cannot wait for that.
Roger Moore's final movie.
I mean, good. Finally. I mean, it needs to be done now for sure. It needs to be done. Yeah. And then Dalton onto your favorite Bond. Really looking forward to that.
Yeah. Living Daylights is so good.
Is that the first of the two or the second of the two?
Yeah. License to Kill is okay, but Living Daylights is great.
Sick. Well, we'll be getting to that soon. I say soon, it's going to be a while, but I'll say thank you guys. Thank you so much for your time today. That was a blast. I can't wait to discuss the next one with you. Ralph, you're welcome to join us anytime, sir. For Bond. If you like this podcast, please share it, spread the word far and wide, like, rate, and subscribe. It can only help us grow and continue to keep doing this. If anyone is interested in following our film club and the movies we watch on there, you can have a look at our Instagram page, The Film Geeks, to see what we're watching, rating, and awarding. Until then, bye for now.